All right. Again, thank you, the organizers, for the invitation. It's definitely a pleasure to be here and an honor. The title of the talk is slightly different from what's in the program, and that's sort of deliberate since there is at least, I think, a couple of talks that are going to follow. They'll talk about pipe flows. I'll try to talk as little about pipe flows as possible. So, but the idea is sort of, I'll talk about several problems that are connected to each other in terms of ideas, less so in terms of physics maybe, but there are some ideas that actually carry through between them, or carry over from one problem to another, and that's really the point that I wanted to make. The work actually involved a number of students, some undergrads, graduate students, and postdoc. So they contribute to various parts of this. Now, the first part is going to be about fluid turbulence, and the second part, depending upon how much time I have, I'll talk about a problem that really has nothing to do with fluids, or has very little to do with fluids. But when I get to the talk, to the end of it, you'll see what the connection is. So this slide, basically, you know, don't get offended if you don't see your name here, because it's really was. The point of it is to say that the bulk of the studies in applying geometric or dynamical systems ideas to fluid turbulence was in trying to compute exactly coherent structures in minimal flow units or domains that are, you know, not much larger than minimal flow units, right? So most of the exact coherent structure calculations that you see, they have been computed on very small domains with boundary conditions that are spatially periodic, meaning not physical, okay? So the question is, how do we go beyond that limitation, and what happens when we start looking at domains that are really large? So pipe flows, of course, has been a paradigm problem. And in pipe flows, we see that the turbulence starts to localize. Now, of course, this is not the only example. You know, we've heard that just the previous talk where you get turbulent bands in the intermittent regime, right? So it's actually a feature that's generic. Pretty much any fluid, almost any fluid flow, goes through an intermittent regime where there's not only temporal but spatial intermittence, meaning some parts of the domain are laminar, some parts of the domain are turbulent. So that basically motivated lots of studies of solutions that could be used to build the structure, the skeleton for turbulence. So those solutions also have to be spatially localized, right? And John Gibson's group was one among the pioneers. So there are solutions that have spatial localization. So this is for the plane quiet flow. There are solutions that are doubly localized. So after that, solutions that are spatial localized have also been found for Taylor quiet flow. They have been found for channel flow. So this is a solution by Zimmer and Eckert, for example, in 3D. So for a 2D flow, there's a group of solutions found by Messiger and Malibowski. And the question is, so if we understand the structure of those solutions, then this gives us really a lot of understanding, not only on the physical level, but also on the mathematical level of how to use exact coherent structures to understand flows on large spatial domains eventually, right? Now, what I'll concentrate mostly on is the 2D case, because it's the simplest, the easiest to understand. This picture shows the vorticity in a, let's say, long enough, well, not very long, but long enough channel, where if you look to the left or to the right of this disturbance, the flow is basically laminar, right? So you have essentially a parabolic profile. And we, in 2D, everything is very, very simple, of course. You can linearize this the solution around the laminar by perturbing about the base flow. And that, of course, gives you, as we'll know, you know, one way to describe this is using the orthomorphal equation. Now, before you jump up and say, well, that this is just 2D, Now, of course, you could actually do the same thing. You can do the three-dimensional problem if you add the squares equation to it. But the beauty of Sommerfeld, of course, is that you don't really need anything else. You can just solve entirely self-consistently the Sommerfeld equation for the whole normal velocity. And if you wanted to also understand the flow in the third direction, then you could also look at the vorticity, the whole normal vorticity. And so basically, that'll be the extension of the problem. So in 2D, it's actually easier to work with the stream function. So that's the stream function. And we could guess that for the tails, because of the numerics, we typically see tails that are not always, but often exponentially decaying. We can try an ansatz where there is a there's an exponential dependence on position. So when people do linear stability analysis using Sommerfeld, then this wave number is purely real. So this is sort of the conventional way. But in principle, it doesn't have to be. There is no mathematical constraint that says that alpha has to be real. So if you plug in this ansatz into the Sommerfeld equation, then you get a fourth-order boundary value problem with these boundary conditions, which you can actually solve. So to show you what happens if you do that, let me show you one solution that's been computed numerically on much, much, much larger domain than the one that I've actually shown you in the beginning. So this is length 400. And turns out that you actually do need to get use domains that are long enough, because otherwise the effect of periodicity actually screw up the asymptotics. So this is for the Reynolds number of 3800, roughly. And to show you, to explain what's actually shown here, so imagine that this is the stream function. So this is the core region where the disturbance is the largest, the disturbance away from the laminar profile. So if we look at the stream function in the mid-plane, then the logarithm of the absolute value of that is what's shown on the plot above. Okay. So basically, it's just a 1D representation. So in this asymptotic form for the tails, both the wave number needs to be treated in order to describe it. You can see that this is a similar plot. So basically, the tails are exponential in this case in the numerical solution. Both the wave number needs to be treated as a complex number, and the growth rate needs to be treated as a complex number. So this particular solution is actually a relative periodic orbit. So this is the solution traveling with, you know, some group velocity. And in the stationary reference frame, the asymptotics are just given by that ansatz that I've shown you. Okay, so I just separated alpha into real imaginary part and lambda into real imaginary part. But it's more mathematically, in terms of the analysis, it's much easier to work in a moving reference frame, moving with the solution, in which the solution becomes a periodic orbit. And in that reference frame, so once you plug in, you know, in terms of the new coordinate, you get this whole bunch of different terms. And if you look, so this term describes the temporal dependence. And this term describes a temporal dependence. So this term and this term, they have to separately. So for this one, it's basically this is real, right? So this tells you whether the solution is locally in the moving reference frame, growing or decaying. In the co-moving reference frame, it should be neither. It should be marginal, okay? So this exponent should vanish, so we get one solution. And also, this describes the modulation, temporal modulation, right? So once you know the temporal period of the solution, the period of that has to match the period of your solution, okay? So you get another solution. In fact, this could be either the frequency, so t is the period of that relative periodic orbit, so it could be an integer, integer multiple of that in principle, okay? So turns out, the way S enters the asymptotics, for negative values of S, it should describe the trailing tail. For positive, it will describe the leading tail. And in fact, there is a solution with S to these two equations for S less than zero. Oh, by the way, so I guess I should have mentioned this. Sigma and omega are functions of Q and S, okay? So you have two equations for two unknowns, right? So we're solving for Q and S. Equations for two unknowns. So there is a solution with negative S, And it turns out that it has a, that Q is non-zero and omega is non-zero for it. And the stream function is like this. So if you compare the solution for more somewhat filled with numerics, it's basically accurate to three significant digits. We could do better. So basically, this last digits, they're strongly affected by how long the domain is. So if you make the domain longer, you could basically meet this at perfect agreement. But I think you'll all agree that this is in perfect agreement, right?
Yes? What do you mean by the numerical solution?
So numerical solution was computed using running Newton Kurloff on a domain of 400, length 400.
Full Langer
scope. Full Langer scope. Yeah, it's a fully nonlinear. It's a fully non. It's John's code that's just computes 2D. Yeah. Well, technically the code is 3D, but it's in a squished. So yeah, basically it's a 2D solution. Yeah. Okay. So there is also a solution for positive S, and that's what it looks like, right? So it looks very, very different. In that case, actually, Q and omega are both zero, so there's neither temporal nor spatial modulation. And again, you can see that the agreements from Sommerfeld and from numerics, they're essentially in perfect agreement with each other, well, up to the accuracy of the numerics. Now, the structure of this solution, I mean, the Reynolds number, of course, is not even close to what Genta talked about, right? But the structure of that solution is actually fairly similar. The solution at the leading front basically corresponds to a change in the mean flow profile. Basically makes the slope slightly larger. Okay, so promotes supposedly Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. So then that instability develops, saturates. That's the core of the solution, and then it starts decaying. And that decay is, in our case, of course, it's not exactly. You wouldn't call this a Karman vortex sheet, but it's 2D, so of course, you're not going to get the same thing. But structurally, there's a lot of similarity there, right? So.
Thank you. Colm Caulfield, Cambridge. I don't understand. You see a nonlinear structure in the numerical simulation.
Yes.
You describe in terms of a shear instability and so on. And you're comparing it to the eigenfunction of the Orr-Sommerfeld
equation. No. So what I'm saying is that if you think about an instability of this type of disturbance, developing, saturating, okay? So the saturated part, this part, is described in terms of the fully nonlinear, it's Navier-Stokes, without dropping any terms. You cannot, of course, describe it using linear approximation. I'm only talking about Orr-Sommerfeld describing the tails, the leading tail and the trailing tail.
All right, thank you.
Okay, so the comment was, what is the structure of a disturbance that gets amplified, okay? So for this Reynolds number, by the way, I think this is borderline stable. So this is sort of the Reynolds number just above which the solution becomes unstable. I think it goes unstable at about, this solution goes unstable at about Reynolds number 4,000. For this solution, basically it's a linearly stable laminar flow, right? So it shouldn't really have any unstable solutions, but this is only if you talk about solutions that are spatially modulated, that are not attenuated, okay? So there are solutions locally that are attenuated that are actually growing, okay? All right. So just to give you a sense about how the results depend on the Reynolds number, so this is snapshots of that solution for different Reynolds numbers, and what you see is that the solution actually gets broader as the Reynolds number increases. So this black line describes basically the slope of the leading part of the solution, and it's roughly independent of the Reynolds number. The trailing tail actually gets extended as the Reynolds number gets larger. So basically, once the Reynolds number gets large enough, the solution becomes completely delocalized, okay? The exponent, this is not an analytical result, this is a numerical fit. The exponent for the scaling with the Reynolds number, I don't understand it, it's seven quarters. If you have any ideas about where that comes from, I'd be happy to know, but hopefully we'll figure it out. For the modulation, there's basically never modulation for the leading tail. There's modulation with roughly the same wave number for the trailing tail, so there doesn't appear to be any Reynolds number dependence there, okay? So there's one interesting question about what actually controls the speed at which those solutions travel, okay? Now, this is a speed computed, the speed of the co-moving reference framework, the group speed of the solution that's computed using the numerics, fully nonlinear, right? But one could ask, well, can we actually explain what that speed is in terms of the linear theory, in terms of, you know, what happens with the leading tail? And for some systems, that can be done. For subsystems, the linear theory actually describes the speed of the nonlinear waves correctly. In this case, it turns out that that's not the case. So there is a solution. So basically, there are two equations that have to be satisfied for how the growth rate depends on the wave number. They have to be satisfied for the linear from propagation theory to work. If you remember your complex analysis, so one of the equations that follows from this is this one. So this is entirely in terms of real objects, right? So the Cauchy, one of the Cauchy-Riemann conditions. And it turns out that this equation can never be satisfied, okay? So this equation is not satisfied, meaning that you don't have a solution to the system. So the linear from propagation theory actually does not give you any answer. I mean, it's probably both good and bad. What this means is that different solutions at the same Reynolds number will travel with a possibly slightly different velocity, okay? The bad thing, of course, is, you know, it would have been nice if the linear theory actually told us something about the nonlinear solution, well, something more than, you know, just the structure of the tails. But in this case, it doesn't happen to be the case. So it's actually the speed is selected by nonlinear mechanism, meaning that it's the core part of that, where the disturbance is the largest. It's the core part of that solution that actually controls how quickly that solution is moving along. So one could ask whether we can actually understand the full nonlinear solution sort of in a language that's a little bit like, you know, for the snake instability in terms of heteroclinics connecting the different solutions. So in this case, it's complicated because if you think about, so this solution, it's known as a modulated traveling, modulating Tolmich-Lifting wave, the one that Milbovsky and Messiger found. And it's this black thing that's shown in the projection. So this is the velocity v, the no vulnerable velocity is derivative, and the streamwise velocity. So basically, if you move along the solution from positive x to net, well, let's say along the x-axis, then that black thing corresponds to your solution, okay? Now, it's a relative periodic orbit, so it's not a stationary structure. It's actually evolving, right? But it's a periodic in time. So if you pick a corresponding Tolmich-Lifting waves, there is a lower branch and an upper branch. So this is the picture from Milbovsky and Messiger. So this is around Reynolds number 4,000. So this would be the upper branch. This would be the lower branch. And you plot those upper and lower branch. They kind of sit in the right place. But clearly, this black solution doesn't look like a heteroclinic between the one and the other. However, you should understand that there is really nothing that selects the wave number for the Tolmich-Lifting waves. In fact, it's a continuous branch with a range of wave numbers. So in principle, if we were trying to sort of use this idea, then we'll actually need to think about which of those solutions for the constant amplitude Tolmich-Lifting waves are actually relevant, or maybe all of them are relevant, okay? So it's that problem is a bit more complicated than some of the problems that have been analyzed using this approach. So I'll just, you know, talk about two things that are sort of peripherally related to the discussion up until this point. We submitted a paper on this to FISRAF, and on the next day, and also submitted to archives. So on the next day, I get the message from Bruno saying, oh, hey, we published also a paper, or we submitted also a paper that will be published soon, and, you know, there are two papers that appeared on archive at exactly the same day. So on exactly the same day, he and Stefan Zammert used one approach, and we used a slightly different approach. to understand stream-wise localization of solutions. So I'll and I replied to the referee saying, well, you know, there's physical causality. We could respond to the previously published literature, but not to the literature that was actually published or that appeared after we submitted the paper for publication. The referee said, well, it doesn't matter. You have to comment on what they did anyway. So we actually looked at how those two approaches compare. So, and this is kind of interesting. So the alternative approach is you take the linearized Navier-Stokes from which you can derive, of course, or Sommerfeld. And in their case, you look at solutions that are not 2D, that are three-dimensional, right? So there's some dependence on the spanwise coordinate. And then you look at the different components, U, V, W, and pick the one that's dominant. So in this case, it's the streamwise velocity. And then you only take the component of this equation along the U direction, along the streamwise direction. And of all the terms that are in that equation, you plot all of the terms that are in that equation, and you only keep the ones that are dominant, and you drop everything else, and that's what remains, okay? So this equation was actually originally obtained by Brian and Gibson, and the idea is you look for solutions that, again, have this ansatz, this exponential dependence on time and space, and if you do that, then turns out that you get the result that I still don't understand why it is, but I get a result that doesn't make any sense. So they did it for a relative equilibrium. You know, we looked at relative periodic orbits. But if you compute the spectra for the Orr-Sommerfeld, this is the spectrum, and you compute the spectrum, from this equation, you get something that looks qualitatively right, but it's the dominant eigenvalues that are important, and the dominant eigenvalues are completely wrong, okay? So it's not even close, the measuring part is completely off. Also, so remember there's this couple of equations that define the values of Q and S for the asymptotics. So it's the intersections of this straight line with this real part of the eigenvalue, the green curve that defines basically the slope for the leading and the trailing tail. And so this is what the numerics does. Those are perfect agreement. If you compute the real part of the eigenvalue using this equation, you get this blue curve. And it also has two intersections, one for positive, one for negative S, but they're completely wrong. Okay. So I don't, yes?
Yes?
Yeah.
Just before you go on, so are you taking Bruno's simplified equation
Yes.
for your 2D case when he simplified it for his 3D case?
So, yes, so basically everything that can be done in 3D can be done in 2D, right?
Yeah, is the simplification for your 2D the same as the simplification that is relevant in 3D?
I'm pretty sure that it's exactly the
but
same
you're
story.
An error here, right?
Okay.
Is that what's happening? You're actually showing that it's not right.
So, but I think I have an explanation for what the problem is with this approach of looking at one component of linearized Navier-Stokes. Okay. So what they did in the paper is they said, let's look at all those terms, you know, so the different lines, and start dropping terms. So these terms included the blue, the UDX. UDXU, right? So this one is there. The green one is new UIYU, so it's this term. So that's included. The red one, it's this term, okay? But then they said, let's drop the term DPDX, okay? Now, if you look at the term DPDX, it actually has exactly the same magnitude for this leading tail as the term that has been included in this equation, okay? And I don't think that it's actually legal to drop this term. I think that the pressure dependence actually has to be included. Without including the pressure dependence, you cannot get the correct answer. Or Sommerfeld automatically, I mean, it gets rid of pressure, but it's not dropping it, rather. The pressure is included in Or Sommerfeld in implicit way, right? So in this case, it's basically explicitly dropped, and I think that's wrong. So I'd like to get to understand this better and get to the bottom of it to make sure that I truly understand exactly why this breaks down. But it, yes? Yes, the microphone to the audience.
Yeah, Stefan Samad. Yeah, we know that our approach does not work really good for the TS waves, but in my opinion, it was always this magenta term in the approximation which is missing, and which makes the trouble for the TS waves. Because for the TS waves, you have this coupling from the wall normal velocity and the derivative of the mean profile. I think this one you cannot reject for the TS waves. I think the pressure term is really, yeah, it also seems to be large, but it's, as we also wrote in the paper, that the plateau value decreases if you go to larger domains.
So that could also be, okay.
You have a choice, either say your name at the beginning of the question or at the end of it, name and affiliation. You say your name and affiliation.
We did.
Oh, okay.
There's another term that's also suspect, right? So there's a question, what is the range of situations where this analysis based on the linearized Navier-Stokes, not Orff-Sommerfeld, is actually applicable? So there's another issue that, you know, if you wanted to describe the solutions that are relative periodic rather than relative equilibrium, then basically S and C also have to be complex rather than real. But, you know, this is sort of it's a technical point. So anyway, all I'm saying is that I think that, you know, we probably need some additional refinement, although, you know, I do really like that approach as well. And you can see that the structure of equations is actually kind of similar. So if you were to drop this term, then basically this equation and this equation, they're related. You know, the unknown is different field, but it's basically the same operator shows up here and here, although the boundary conditions are different. Okay, so for this is a second order equation, so it has only two boundary conditions. This has four. We actually started working on extending the same sort of ideas to pipe flows, and I'll just say a couple of words and leave the more detailed discussion to others. So this is a couple of solutions, upper branch and lower branch, at roughly comparable Reynolds numbers at m equals 2. So these are also relative periodic orbits. So the question is, you get nice exponential tails. So the question again, can the structure of these tails be understood in basically the same mathematical formalism as we used to understand the scaling for the channel flow? So we haven't done the full analysis. So this is just, you know, it's a toy problem. So for m equals 0 mode, actually the analysis is very simple. You get the boundary value problem by writing this velocity in, you know, in terms of basically a stream function. You get also a fourth order equation. So this is the green line is the real part of this eigenvalue lambda that you get using this way. And then the intersection with the red line should give you the solution. So again, you get a positive one and a negative one. So this would describe the leading tail. This one would describe the trailing tail. The one that describes the solution, the intersection with that we described, the leading tail, is actually ballpark correct, even though it's the wrong m. The numerical solutions have 0.25 or 0.15, so this is around 0.2. This is a little off, but, you know, again, you know, have to take it with a huge grain of salt, right? But the interesting thing is that if you look at how the growth rate, the real part of the growth rate depends on s, it actually has the right spirit that it's actually monotonically increasing function of s. And physically, that has to be the case. So there is another calculation which actually can technically give you the answer for any m that's due to Messager and Trefethen, and that's been sort of a benchmark. It's a benchmark 2000 paper for doing a stability analysis of pipe flows. And it gives a result which is completely wrong. I mean, it's physically wrong. So yes, I don't know what the deal is. So what exactly is wrong? I mean, they technically say that the wave number has to be real, but so maybe it's really that, and for some reason the analysis actually doesn't really apply when the wave number becomes complex, but it doesn't work here. Anyway, so I guess what's important. So I think the important thing that, and I'll stop here. So I think the important thing is that you can get excellent agreement for at least some features of numerically computed solutions. You can do prediction using essentially an approach which I wouldn't say it's analytic, it's semi-analytic, right? Using the Dorsal Morphold equation. And I think it gives us a ton of intuition about what's going on. And I think it can be expanded to a great number of different geometries, but this is something that is still a work in progress. And so I guess we'll all contribute in one way or another to this as time goes on. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Right, we had some
Okay, Daniel Laquene, Princeton. I'm picking myself to get the microphone. So here you showed how if you do this nonlinear simulation in a really big domain, a lot of that domain is actually just picking out this linear solution, which you've
shown. It has to, right.
And so could you use this to simplify the nonlinear domain, the nonlinear simulation, by only doing a nonlinear simulation in a short domain and then matching it onto these tails?
Yeah. So yes and no, right? So on the one hand, you could say, since I know the asymptotics, I could truncate the domain, do the simulation on a much smaller domain, and it'll be much cheaper simulation, and everything will be perfect, right? The problem, it's conceptually true, and we thought about this, but the problem is that you need to know, in order to compute the asymptotics, you need to know the speed, okay? And the speed turns out, actually, the speed is the most sensitive to how large the domain is. The speed changes rather significantly. Let's say even if you go from 300 to 400, you see that that affects the speed of the solution. I kind of did not expect that, but turns out that the speed is a part of the nonlinear solution, right? And in order to get it correctly, you need a domain which is long enough. So if linear theory worked, if linear theory actually were able to predict the speed at which those solutions moved, that would have been just wonderful in that sense, because that immediately tells you that you need to use that particular value. If you know your calculations, you can chop off your computational domain, everything would be perfect.
And there's no way to do some loop where you simultaneously find the speed and the nonlinear part?
I wouldn't say that it's impossible to do, but I can't say that it's going to work either, because we haven't thought about this long and deep enough to actually give you a meaningful answer.
Rich Kurzweil, Bristol. Can I just ask some questions about your plot where you had Messinger and Trefethen? Yes. So I didn't quite get what you were doing here. That blue line, obviously, is completely...
So the blue line is, you look at the M equals zero mode.
Why?
The growth rate...
Why do you look at that mode?
Okay, so... So you could do M equals two, okay? And we did look at M equals two. M equals two gives you the same meaningless result. Actually, any M gives you basically the wrong physical dependence on S.
This is using just a real wave number, is that right?
No. Yeah. Complex. Matching. Complex.
So Q is
zero for this particular calculation.
Right.
And S is not. Okay, S is not zero.
Yeah.
So the physical intuition is really trivial. So if you have a disturbance like that, that's moving. Okay?
Yeah.
If it's moving in this direction, basically it has to get exponentially amplified.
Yeah.
If you have a disturbance that's like this, and it's also translating, then the disturbance has to decay. Okay. So basically, any calculation, we can only believe it as long as sigma increases with S.
But you're solving the same. These two lines are solving the same linear system. Is that correct? It's just a question of which solution you choose from that linear system.
Yes, correct.
Okay.
Same linear system, just two different. I mean, both are spectral codes. So basically, this is solved using ChepFun. This is solved using projection technique, but.
So you're using Trefethen's own package to show that these results are wrong.
DLCS that's, charge.
That's mean.
Any other questions?
I didn't understand a lot of it. Can we just go back to your
yes.
AP problem?
Which one?
The thing you started with, the two-dimensional plane channel. I just want to ask, yeah, way back. Any of these will do, probably. Yeah, no. So you never mentioned spatial stability analysis, and these words never came up. So I'm just trying, I was trying to connect what you were saying to that. Okay, so Dwight Barclay Warwick, and Carlos, Carlos seems to be jumping at wanting to answer this. So I'm just trying to, if you know the frequency, don't worry about that it's modulated. There's a frequency, there's a dominant frequency here, and then there's a modulation on top of that. Maybe I misunderstand the most basic thing. Is that? I mean, there's a Tolman-Schlichting wave here, and that has a dominant frequency, and then there's a modulation on top of that.
I'm not sure that that's really the right way to think about. So the Tolman-Schlichting wave is a nonlinearly saturated solution with its own frequency.
But isn't that what those wiggles are?
That part, actually, no. This solution, this core part of the solution, this modulated Tolman-Schlichting wave, is actually it's quite different from the TS wave. We hoped it would be very, very similar.
Okay, hold.
It's not true.
But okay, you say it's quasi-periodic. Is that not the case?
It's a relative periodic solution.
Okay, so take that frequency that you took out, which presumably is something like the frequency of the waves that you see in this tail. There's a frequency associated with that tail, is there not?
So there's frequency associated with that tail.
Now, if you do spatial stability analysis of Orr Sommerfeld using that frequency, you'll get a spectrum as a function of K. And if you take the dominant one of those, do you get that tail? I mean,
sure.
Is that a good question?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
And you do?
Of course. But that's exactly the same thing that you get by solving the boundary value problem for our semaphore. It's precisely what you get. Sure. I mean, either way you do this problem, you're going to get, if the result is correct, you're going to get the same thing no matter how you do it.
John Gibson, University of New Hampshire. Maybe the thing that's going on here, there's because of that nonlinear core, there's a lot of other Orr Sommerfeld stuff happening down in the tails. I mean, there are multiple linear modes that.
So actually, let me actually tell you.
That's smaller. Much smaller.
So,
but when they all come together, they get the same magnitude in the core.
Okay. So let me answer that point. So I just need to get. So okay. See, there's a whole spectrum, right? So you get a mode for each of those eigenvalues. Okay. So the asymptotics that I showed you were computed based on this mode. This is the most unstable mode, okay? So all the asymptotics were computed using the leading mode in the eigenvalue spectrum, okay? If you take this one or this one or this one or that one, you'll get another mode. They're much more strongly damped, okay? So basically for a solution moving at the right velocity, they'll decay when this one will not, okay? However, there's one thing that I didn't tell you. So if you look at this equation, it has one solution and another solution, right? So there's this solution, which has a negative S that describes the trailing tail. It has no spatial modulation, okay? And it's not there. So technically, for the trailing part, there are actually two modes. There is a mode that has a spatial modulation, and there is a mode that doesn't have a spatial modulation. The mode that doesn't have spatial modulation is not in the numerical solution, okay? So our explanation for this is that if you look at the core actually selects, so basically you have a nonlinear solution that you represent in a Taylor series, or a Fourier series rather. and you only pick the solutions for the tail that correspond to the modes that are present in the nonlinearly saturated solution. So for that reason, that solution doesn't show up because there is no Q equals zero mode in the core.
Okay, so Rich Kurzweil, Bristol, asking another question. So can I just talk or ask you a question about your basic philosophy here? You're talking about tails and relating them to the linear operator around the base state, and then there's a core. Now, I mean, for me, the core is central and the tails are secondary. Do you agree with that, or are you advocating in this talk that the tails are actually more important than that, maybe even be primary?
No, I'm not saying that they're primary. I'm saying that there is a way to understand at least some features of the nonlinear solution using linear approximation. The tails, I don't think it's correct to say that the tails are less or more important than the core. I think they're all important, just for different things, okay? So for instance, if you are trying to understand, so there's an open question of how large those spatial localized solutions are, how long they are, okay? The solution is not given by the length of the core because the tails could be very long. It's also not given by the tails because the core could be of a different length. So if we're trying to understand, so let's say, you know, roll back to for instance, pipes. So how long is that turbulent slug? In order to understand that, we need to understand both the core and the tails. Also, another aspect, if we're trying to understand intermittency, it's not enough to compute those localized solutions. We'll eventually need to understand how they interact. And the interaction for the interaction, it's critical to understand what the tails are. And the structure of the tails is very important, okay? So I sort of intentionally structured the talk so, you know, I'll spend most of it about fluid dynamics, and if I have a little bit of time, I'll maybe talk about another problem that has nothing to do with fluids, but we basically haven't, I mean, I don't know to sort of, you know, I can't be 100% certain, but of all the people that I talk to about spatial localized solutions, very few have actually thought about what happens with the pressure. What's the localization for the pressure? And I think the localization for the pressure is very important and very underappreciated. Because, you know, again, in my talk, I basically talked about what the asymptotics are for the flow profile, right? There wasn't a word about the pressure. So I think in order to understand interaction, we need to understand what these asymptotics are for the pressure as well as the flow fields. And my suspicion is that the pressure plays at least an as important role as the asymptotics for the flow fields.
Well, they go together, don't they, through the linear operator,
right? Yeah.
Good question in the back, maybe?
Yeah, Edgar Knobloch, Berkeley. I just wanted to make a comment that for nonlinear solutions, there is a priori no reason why the tails have to correspond to the what's called the leading eigenvalue, the eigenvalue that's closest to the imaginary axis.
Absolutely.
So you can have different decay rates, you know,
absolutely,
for nonlinear structures.
Absolutely.
And, you know, they would, of course, be part of the linear theory, but you have to do this matching through the nonlinear region to get the right decay.
That's so. I guess yes and no. I think if you're talking about this from a purely mathematical standpoint, I would agree with you completely that if you just want to compute a solution, a nonlinearly saturated solution could have any asymptotics, whatever. They don't have to correspond to the modes that are the most unstable. Physically, I don't think this is realistic because it's the most unstable modes that really control the growth of disturbances. So I would suspect that for physical systems, we're likely to see tails that are actually, they actually do correspond to the most unstable modes. But, you know, again, this is with a grain of salt.
All right, we probably should leave it there. Thank
Roman again, and move on to Carlos.